I have to start my talk, and this is a joint work with Stefanos Vinakidis and Xin Zhu. And since Stefanos in his talk gave a pretty well overview and introduction to the subject, I will go straight to the business. So this is the nonlinear focusing Schrodinger equation that we are talking about. And we're studying the limit when epsilon approach zero. So that's a semi-classical limit. The initial conditions are being taken on in this form, where particular choice of A and S prime is as showing above, here. Here mu is a positive parameter. It can be so everywhere in this paper we consider mu strictly greater than zero. This choice of this special family of initial data has a number of advantages. One of them is that it contains both soliton and soliton-less cases for different values of parameter mu. And by soliton, I mean the presence of the pure point spectrum in the corresponding Zakharov-Shabbat problem. The other advantage is that we can solve exactly the direct scattering problem for this family of potentials. But in our analysis, actually, it's only helpful but not crucial circumstance, because we really use asymptotics of this scattering data. So the main theme, as Stefanos has indicated, the main theme of the subject is the connection between this problem and between this semi-classical limit of the focusing NLS and the corresponding hyperelliptic surface. So that's how it works. For a given pair of x and t, we construct we get a corresponding Riemann surface that depends on xt but not on epsilon. So that surface is epsilon independent, and it consists of a number of cuts. Of course, there is a symmetry, and we read off the answer from this surface in terms of theta functions, corresponding basis of holomorphic differentials, and so on. So essentially, the subject of the talk is how to make a correspondence between the semi-classical limit of this problem and the corresponding Riemann surface. Now, I know that this transparencies are flying in all directions. So here is some numerics that illustrates the type of behavior that we have, courtesy of David Kai. It actually shows the evolution of the Gaussian initial data in two cases. In the case, which here epsilon is some small but fixed value, in the case of defocusing NLS and in the case of focusing NLS. So here is x direction. Here is a time direction, and the third direction is the absolute value of the solution. So you see that as evolution starts with this Gaussian potential, and in the process of here is time, in the process of evolution, you see that there is some sort of phase change curve, or as Stefanos mentioned it, it's sort of caustic in xt plane. After that changes the character of behavior of solutions. We refer to it as a breaking curve. So if we project it on the xt plane, so that curve going somewhere here is a breaking curve. And apparently, if one looks carefully, there is at least the numerics indicate that there is another breaking curve, and maybe if time evolved further, there would be more. Who knows? So I would like to, as probably intuition says, this presence of this breaking curve is related to change of genus of the corresponding Riemann surface. So before going to the subject more details, I'm always concerned that I wouldn't have time to formulate the result, the finite result. So I would start with formulation of the result, and then for the rest time I will relax. Fill in some details. So I'd like to put it here. So our statement is our main statement goes like this. So here is the xt plane, and we prove that there is exists a breaking curve given by this green line that separates the region of genus zero. That means we have only one cut on the corresponding hyperelliptic surface from the region of genus two above it. This breaking curve has nice properties. It's smooth, monotonic in one direction, and we know asymptotics near zero and near infinity, so it forms a corner. Now, in the case when we have no solitons, that means parameter mu of our initial data is greater or equal to 2, the genus 2 region extends to the whole plane above the breaking curve. In the case when there are solitons, we expect or suspect, I don't know what's the better word, that there may be some higher genuses, regions above there. However, this work is in progress and I cannot report anything definite about it. excuse me? No genus one, yes. It's genus zero, genus two, but it's even, genus is even here. So here is a more precise. What I just said in words is here given in it's formulated here. So here is asymptotics at near the origin of the breaking curve, and asymptotics at infinity is here. Moreover, we can construct in the genus zero region the leading order behavior of solution. As I said, it is explicitly expressed in terms of those branch points alpha, and as there is only one branch point, so the expression is given here, and also we have the error estimate in genus zero region. As you go to higher genus, the expression for leading order term becomes more involved, and essential part here is this theta functions associated with the Riemann surface. You see, as I mentioned, those theta functions, they do not depend on epsilon. There is no dependence on epsilon. However, dependence on epsilon is hidden in this W hat, because W hat contains this epsilon over here. So although the Riemann surface itself does not have this oscillation associated with a small parameter epsilon, however, some parameters inside theta functions do have those oscillations. And that... No. Oh, U are... No, U, it's just a number. U is this. It's integral of... basis of holomorphic differentials. Right. We work on one sheet of the. Now I would like to maybe it would be a good idea to remind basically. So, as I said, up from now, as result has been formulated, I'm sorry, I forgot one more part. If time permits, I would also like to discuss the behavior of this limit as epsilon goes to zero, the behavior of Q in the sort of double limit, epsilon goes to zero and time goes to infinity. That is the result of our latest paper, and I will show some results related to that. So this is a standard scheme for inverse scattering. So in order to reconstruct the solution, we will use this scheme. And in order to perform the inverse I want to point your attention that in this, because we're talking of a semi-classical limit, so the Zakharov-Shabbat system is a singularly perturbed system. So, it looks that things are getting harder because of that, but in fact, it's good to turn what seems to be disadvantage to turn into advantage. So we will use of course, this limit. We will use this fact that epsilon goes to zero while solving the inverse scattering problem through the Riemann-Hilbert formalism. And again, Percy Davitt and Shin Zhu and Stefanos told in length about this method, so I would go very, very sketchy. So the inverse scattering problem for our precise situation can be formulated in the following way. We need to find problem has name T0. We have to find an analytic 2x2 matrix valued function M0 of Z that should be analytic everywhere except our contour. And our contour consists of the real axis. And in the case when we have solitons, a number of little circles around the points of the spectrum. And I have mentioned before that the direct spectral problem was solved exactly in this case, so there are no question about this, where those points are and stuff like that. This analytic matrix function M0 should satisfy this jump condition with a jump matrix V0 over here on the real axis. And to save some time, let's ignore those poles. Let's assume for a while that they are not present, just to save time. Where the function R is a reflection coefficient multiplied by this term that corresponds to time evolution. Again, it was well discussed before, so I wouldn't pay too much attention at it now. Now, suppose that this matrix function M should be normalized at infinity in this fashion. And suppose we find this solution. So suppose we know this matrix function M, then the solution to the nonlinear Schrödinger equation will be given by this term, where M1 is this matrix. Now, let's look again at the problem, and suppose that our jump matrix is just identity. Then the solution of the problem will be also identity, and there is no problem. So if we want to find out which part of this contour contains the information that we are interested in, we need to analyze at what parts of the contour this matrix this jump matrix approaches identity in the limit as epsilon goes to infinity, and the other parts where it either oscillates or grows exponentially will be the parts from which we want to extract the information. So a very simple analysis of this sort shows, and again, we have, as I mentioned, exact expression for the reflection coefficient. So if I use this, in the case mu greater than 2, it is a very simple formula for absolute value of the reflection coefficient. So it's just this, where T capital is this constant. So in the case mu greater than 2, it's a real constant. So you see immediately that the behavior, so we fix some point Z, so the behavior of this R will be either exponentially small or exponentially large, depending on the relation between this mu over 2 and Z. So that means that inside this interval, we will have this coefficient exponentially growing, and everywhere outside it will be exponentially decaying. Same situation for M less than 2, just the formula is different. So therefore, our problem is how to deal with this Riemann-Hilbert problem in the limit when epsilon goes to zero, then the jump matrix exponentially grows at this interval. And the goal here would be through a number of reductions And I hope I will I don't plan to go through each of the steps, reduce this problem to the problem with a piecewise constant jump matrix. The Riemann-Hilbert problem with piecewise constant jump matrices, and when I say piecewise constant, I mean constant with respect to spectral parameter Z, where in the Z complex plane, of course, not with respect to X and T, our external parameters. So this model Riemann-Hilbert problem with piecewise constant coefficient will essentially a main building block to construct our approximation. And of course, to estimate the error, we need to understand how much of stuff we threw away, how much of accuracy we threw away by this process of reduction. So our first step would be so this is a bad interval, so we will first perform, so our first step is to perform some sort of surgery, if you know what is hair transplant, when they cut a hair in many pieces, so we will cut it in two pieces at the beginning and do simultaneous factorization of the jump matrix. So let's go to the next slide. So our first step is to do that. So we cut, this is a bad piece of a contour. We cut it in two and deform it in this and that fashion. And so after a little algebra, one can redefine another Riemann-Hilbert problem called M1, where the jump matrix here is V minus, which is this upper triangular, and the jump matrix here is V plus inverse. That is this matrix with negative sign here. So that way, if our original jump matrix would be just oscillatory here, then we can hope that maybe if we deform factors a little bit, the factors may become exponentially small. But as it was exponentially growing, there is no such hope. So still, even deformed Riemann-Hilbert problem should have exponentially growing jump matrices. The advantage, however, that we made the jump matrix triangular, at least. Our next, I have temptation to skip the next slide, but out of honest reporting, I should say that at this stage we do a little bit of redefining our problem. So instead of considering actual reflection coefficient R of Z epsilon, we take the approximation, the leading order approximation of this coefficient. So that is to say, speaking rigorously, by doing this, we are changing our initial data. But the fact that but as we show down the road, as we reconstruct the solution to our Riemann-Hilbert problems for all times, including time equal to zero, the error that we introduce this way is of order epsilon. So in fact, by doing so, we are changing our initial data by something of order epsilon. So we can as well say that instead of working with our actual initial data, we are working with a little bit deformed initial data in such a way that the exact reflection coefficient is R of Z is replaced by this expression where the function F of Z computed from the known reflection coefficient is given by this formula. So this formula looks a little bit complicated. It's a bunch of logarithms and stuff. It came as a Stirling approximation of our actual reflection coefficient which consists of a number of gamma functions. I want to mention, however, the crucial difference, and that is whether the value t, which is this value, is real or purely imaginary. If it is real, then this function in the upper half plane has no singularities. The only singularity is as you approach infinity and or somewhere on the real axis. However, if t is purely imaginary, there will be singularity over this cut from minus t to t. And this singularity, this logarithmic branching happening at the point t n minus t, is in fact our condensed eigenvalues of pure point spectrum. In the process of taking limit, these eigenvalues were condensed into some cut over here. So I'm going to the next and crucial step, from the point of view of the connection that I want to establish with the Riemann-Hilbert problem. So now we have the Riemann. So somehow we need to take away this exponentially growing behavior of our jump matrix. And we will try to do so by introducing change of variables. Change of variables here, M2, that is the Riemann-Hilbert, solution of Riemann-Hilbert problem, index 2 indicates that is after we take Stirling approximation. And so we introduce the next Riemann-Hilbert problem, M3, by doing this linear change of variables. Pretty much as you solve system of linear differential equation, you can do linear changes of variables of the dependent variable. So pretty much similar thing we are doing here. However, you may ask, what is this function g of z? Well, that is something to be determined. Right now, we don't know what is g of z, but we will start to develop some list of demands or list of requirements that this g of z is meant to satisfy. So first of all, let's observe that if we do this change of variables, then the jump matrix V2 will be transformed to a new jump matrix V3 in the following fashion. If V2 consists of 1, 1, and as you remember, it was a lower triangular. I'm talking about upper lip of the. Let me find out. Yeah, so I'm talking now about because of the symmetry, it's enough to consider everything, say, in the upper half plane. So I'm talking about this part of the contour, and here the jump matrix is this lower triangular. R is replaced by 2i epsilon times f. So if I take, and this was jump matrix V2. After this transformation, it will have this form, right, where G is a known matrix. And symbolically, it can be written as A inverse and some other quantity B. So far, our requirements to G is that it has to be analytic in the extended complex plane except of our contour. Now, however, let's take advantage of. So again, the goal is to remove exponentially growing behavior, and in order to do that, let's take advantage of these two different factorizations of this matrix. Factorization number one, you see, will produce the anti-diagonal matrix in the middle with some triangular matrices on the side, and there is another possibility which will produce diagonal matrix and lower triangular matrix. So based on this factorization, we can place our hope on the fact that we can arrange things in such a way that this quantities B will be constants with respect to Z. As I said, we are aiming to reduce our problem to a problem with piecewise constant jump matrix. So let's hope that we can arrange things that this B will be constant with respect to Z, and those factors will be dying out to identity matrices. That means that this and this guy should decay, should have exponential decay. So that is for this factorization. Now, can we hope that this factorization will hold on the whole contour in the upper half plane? It would be too much to hope for that. Therefore, we can hope that this factorization holds at least at some parts of this contour, where at the other parts of this contour, maybe another factorization takes hold. I mean, factorization, of course, obviously takes hold, but that we can arrange things such that this quantity A will be constant over there, whereas this quantity will be dying out to will become exponentially small. So if I try to to formalize what I just said, so we hope that the whole contour gamma can be divided into pieces, which we called main arc and complementary arc, such that on the main arc, B is a constant, and those guys go to infinity, correspondingly to the right and to the left of the contour. And on the complementary arc, A is a constant, and either this quantity goes to zero or that quantity goes to zero. So that's exact translation of what I said before. If we can do, if we can arrange that, and that is still a big, big question if we can, but if we can, that will reduce our problem to the one with the piecewise constant jump matrices. Now let's continue this translation process, and now I would like to write the previous conditions, to write these conditions in a form of conditions on the function G. Then direct translation will give us the following system of conditions, where now by saying that say B is a constant and A is a constant, it's the same that to say that this expression is equal to some constant W, and correspondingly this expression is equal to some omega, and this constants W and omega would better be real constants. Because as you remember, they stay, this quantity stays in the exponential multiplied by 2i over epsilon. So we want it to be real. And we also have some inequalities here. Now, the next step is to introduce the, and by the way, it's good to notice that although we don't know this function g, but we already have some sort of conditions on g. Right, there are hard conditions like equalities and soft conditions like inequalities, and hard conditions themselves looks like a little bit like some Riemann-Hilbert problem now for the scalar function g. So it's an additive Riemann-Hilbert problem for a scalar function g, of course, if you know the contour and if you know those constants. We still don't know this information, but the next step is a translation. So we are still doing analysis of what we would gain if we would happen to have such function g. So in order to do the next step, let's introduce this function h. It's just 2g minus f. And all that I want to do is just to rewrite these conditions in terms of this function h. It's very easy to see that this is the way they can be written. So this is the same condition as above now becomes in terms of h written this way. But now one can also see that because W is a real constant, and we have this condition. That means that the contour gamma M is a zero level curve of the function H, right? And this condition means actually that H should be surrounded, that the contour gamma, excuse me, contour gamma C should lie in the region where imaginary part of H is positive. So let me illustrate this on the following picture. So this is how it looks like. So here is our contour gamma M, and it should be and the signs here are the signs of imaginary part of the corresponding function H that has a jump on this contour. So in the case of main contour, the sign structure should be negative on both sides. In the case of complementary part of the contour, the sign structure should be positive on both sides. And from this picture, it's clear that at the branch point here, we should have at least three zero level curves. One is this, and the other two are here, coming out from the branch point. So that gives us some information about branching that we should have here. And of course, here this is another way of writing what I said. And let me just flash how it looks in reality. In reality, we will have in the genus 2 case, we will have the following situation. Here is one main curve, arc. This is another main arc. This is a complementary arc, and that would be another complementary arc, and this is a sign distribution of H. So this is the real situation of what is happening. Now we can go. So again, under assumption that such function g exists, which is still a big assumption, now we can write jump matrix V3, say, on the main arc in this form, and then we're saying that this is that this approaching identity matrix, this is approaching identity matrix, on the right and correspondingly on the left of this curve. So what remains is this, right? So that is a piecewise constant matrix that we will have on the main arc, and that is a piecewise constant matrix that we will have on the complementary arc. So finally, again, under a big assumption that such a G function exists, we will reduce our Riemann-Hilbert problem to the model Riemann-Hilbert problem, which has this type of jump matrices on the main arcs, showing in green now, and on the complementary arcs, this showing in blue. So essentially, using this matrix, using this, so you see this points alpha give us our hyperelliptic surface. And from this information, we can construct the approximation to the solution. So my talk will be over if I can show that such gamma, such function g of z indeed exists. So that's the point of showing. And of course, it's not limited, this analysis is not limited to our case. So far, the analysis was not limited to our particular choice of the initial data. These were some general considerations. Now I would try to derive, it's not that I am proving right now that such G exists, but I would like to derive some conditions that allow us to determine this function G. And of course, to determine this function, I should start somewhere. And the first place to start is to say where from we can get those points alpha of this hyperelliptic surface. How can we get them? So now remember that I said that the function g can be viewed as satisfying some sort of a scalar Riemann-Hilbert problem. Well, it's because these constants, we have no idea what they are. It's better to jump from this problem to the differentiated version of this problem. Then these constants disappear. So now I require this. Now, function f I know. That's essentially our reflection coefficient that I know. So I have a well-posed Riemann, again, it's not completely well-posed to Riemann-Hilbert problem, but I can assume in my imagination I can have some main and complementary arcs, and I have the right-hand side F, so I want to solve this Riemann-Hilbert problem. And if you don't want solution to have singularities in the finite complex plane, that is the only way to solve this Riemann-Hilbert problem, where R is the square root that was in the talk of Stefanos. So that is the Riemann, that is the hyperelliptic surface determined by the square root. Now, as I said that this is the expression for the g prime of z if point z is, of course, should be away from this from our contour of integration. So that's our contour of integration, and point g is outside. And of course, we can deform using the fact that f prime is analytic. We can deform the contour of integration like that, and so it will be referred as figure 8. That's our real contour of integration. So if z is outside, we get function g prime. However, if you put the point z inside, then we get what we call function h divided by 2. So to get h from g, it's just enough to put this point z inside this loop of integration. Right. Well, we have to exclude this case. Well, we don't want them to be real. No, If they are real, we will have a problem computing those integrals because they come in pairs, they would have too much of singularity. We will prove that this is not happening. I'm not saying that in general that it cannot happen. All I'm saying that in our case, we specifically prove that this is not the case. But in general, it may happen. Okay, so now how would we enforce, or what are considerations to determine those points alpha? As you see, we had a requirement that function g is analytic at infinity, right? And from the formula that I flashed here, you see that this r of z is a polynomial. Well, it's not a polynomial. It's an algebraic expression, but it has a high degree of z as z goes to infinity. So that gives us a set of conditions which we called moment conditions to guarantee that g prime behaves as O capital of z minus 2 at infinity. So the number of condition is 2n plus 2. It's still not enough, but at least that guarantees us that we have analyticity at infinity. So suppose we choose alpha satisfying those conditions, then we can get function g just by integrating g prime. G prime was on the previous slide, so this is g, and we have some real constant. We have some constant to play with, and of course, as you see, that is not enough. So we need to gain some other conditions, and the remaining n capital conditions. Because if you count all those points, we need what? 4n plus 2 conditions. And the remaining conditions, do we need 4n plus? Yeah, we need 4n plus 2 conditions. And the remaining conditions are coming from the fact that we want these constants w and omega in the original Riemann-Hilbert problem to be real. And it is possible to show, and because of the lack of time, I have to skip some things, it is possible to show that these conditions are equivalent to the requirement that imaginary part of H at the branch points are equal to zero, where K is 0, 1, and so on, n. Right? That is equivalent to that, and this way we get a right number of conditions to determine alpha. Now, you can ask, how do we know H? Well, if we know G prime, then we know G. And if we know G, then we know H, because G and H are simply connected through a simple relation. So finally, we get a system which we called moment and integral conditions, which we determined F, which depends on alpha, X, and T. So it is a system of 4n plus 2 equations and 4n plus 2 unknowns that are real and imaginary parts of those alphas with even indices. Okay, so now we can roughly express our scheme. Still, this is not a proof that such function g exists. It's just some analysis how to get those alphas. So now what can we do? So this is a rough scheme. If you want to find a solution at the point x and t, I mean semi-classical approximation, all you need to do is choose n. Then find alpha j, the corresponding system of alpha, solving the moment and integral conditions. If we have this alpha, we can construct the function h, take imaginary part of h, and study the signs of the, draw the zero level curves of this function, and study the signs. And if we have the right, if there is a curve connecting the points mu over 2 and minus mu over 2, and if the sign structure is correct, then we are done. If we are not done, then choose another n and repeat the procedure until we are done. Still, this is a nice algorithm, but it still proves nothing. So what we need to prove now, we need to show that indeed we can choose right n, solve the system of equations, and so on and so forth. Okay, so the rest of how much time do I have? What? I don't know. This watch shows 7 or 8 or something. Okay. So if I am out of doubt at time. Okay. So the way we do our analysis is the following. For the case t equal to zero, we made an assumption that let's assume that the genus is zero. And in this case, we were able to solve, then everything simplifies significantly, and we can find the corresponding alpha and function h explicitly. So we found it, and then we indeed proved that for a given function h and for a given alpha that we found, indeed all these conditions, sine distribution and everything satisfies. So we got a solution for h for time equal to zero, and the corresponding distribution of sines looked like that. Right? So we have this main arc, complementary arc, distribution of sine, and one extra leg of the zero level curve of h. That is t equals zero. Now I'd like to show you a quick cartoon what happens when we start to evolve time. Again, because everything is in explicit form, we can show that for small time, but positive, we have another leg of zero level curve coming from infinity. As time grows, this leg will eventually intersect the complementary arc. So that is a breaking moment when this situation happens, because the distribution of sines away from complementary arc, they should be always pluses on this side and minuses on this side, is broken at one point. So then our scheme fails to work, and in order to rectify it, we need to introduce we need to increase the genus, and again there is a procedure that we can do and get the following picture. So that is after the break. So we see that the sine structure is reconstructed. Now I would like so that way we obtained, we proved the theorem that I mentioned at the very beginning. So again, the point is that at the time zero, we can compute everything and have and check, verify by hand that we have a good control. And here, of course, we use the fact that we are doing with our particular reflection coefficient. Of course, if you have another reflection coefficient, you will have to repeat this work for another reflection coefficient. But otherwise, the propagation to view the propagation, you just have to consider the topology of zero level curve and, of course, watch singularities of the function f in the upper half plane. Now, in the remaining part, I would like to mention, to show how we work with this, and that is supposed to be brief, how we work with this moment MI conditions. And here is a little slide how we work with them. So that is geared to the case n genus 2, so n equals 1, so we should have 6 equations. So 6 equation meaning 4 moment conditions and 2 integral conditions. And so the moment conditions are simplified if instead of integrating this way, we blow up our contours to be like that. Then we can we end up with integration along real line and residue at infinity. And if we do so, our moment conditions will look like that. So here is this function signum zeta, which happened to be imaginary part of our f prime, right? The just computation or just luck. So that makes it so simple and nice to work with. And integral conditions are written this way. And I would like to show you our results about long time asymptotics that follow from this moment and integral conditions. And one more thing that related to this moment and integral conditions, it's actually if we have this equation f of x moment and integral conditions, of course it's good to show local solvability. I mean, it's good to compute the determinant. And we got a very nice formula for determinant. Df over d alpha is given by this expression, where this double integral is this double integral happens to be the determinant of corresponding holomorphic differentials. And now it's a simple corollary that the Jacobian is different from zero if alpha j are distinct one condition, and the second condition that this ratio, each of the products over here, is different from zero. Now, of course, this you can say, well, R at the point, R is the square root, computed it at the point alpha to j, it gives you singularity like square root. But this guy also has a square root behavior, so they cancel each other, and that's fine. Even if you, two points collide, still this, so of course you will have zero here, but this part will still be okay, will still be non-zero. So based on this type of analysis and some sort of inequalities, we were able to prove that for all in the case when without solitons, we have all this alpha to j, x, and t are finite and staying away from the real axis. Now I have something quick to flash. So we also studied the long time behavior of this of those alphas. How do they depend when time is large? And these are the formulas that we obtained, namely the points at the right and the left. We have these three branch points. Two of them are actually pictured here. Two of them are approaching these points mu over 2 and minus mu over 2 exponentially fast, as shown here, right? And the third one has the approaching like 1 over square root of t. So therefore, the final answer essentially will depend only on that one, the slowest point. And really, if we write the expression for the finite answer, and this is the last slide, it looks like that. So long time behavior of q of x and t. Of course, we first take limit as epsilon goes to zero, and then take limit as t goes to infinity. So it has this behavior 1 over square root of t. And here is the expression for the phase, and that is the error term. And the other error term comes from here. And here you see that we have this requirement that this expression should approach minus infinity, right? And that essentially means that time is less than logarithm of epsilon. Time grows, but slower than logarithm of epsilon. So I'm done.